Ladies and gentlemen of the Open Drama UK Company, this is your half-hour call. Open Drama UK is proud to present a monthly podcast related to theatre and drama education by people in the know. Put your headphones on, grab a cup of tea and get ready.
Hello and welcome to this month's half-hour call. And we've got a very special guest with us today. We've got a visitation from Mark Wheeler. We've recently spent quite a lot of time together at the amazing one-day conference at Mast in Southampton, and we thought we'd just spread the word and enjoy the chat for more people than that we were able to speak to at that event, on that event. So let's start at the beginning. How did it all start? What was the beginning?
Well, the beginning was David Bowie, obviously, as everything is. It was watching his Ziggy Stardust performance, actually Aladdin Sane performance, in 1973 at the Bristol Colston Hall, where he did something at the beginning of the concert that I couldn't understand how it had happened. So his backing band, the Spiders from Mars, came on stage and did the introduction to the song. And then, as if by magic, I was looking everywhere for where he was. And as if by magic, he suddenly appeared in the middle. And I had no idea how they did it. It was what I've later referred to as the magic of theatre. And I can remember in a French exam the following morning, sitting at my little 15-year-old self, not doing the French exam, trying to figure out how he'd done it. And I only discovered many years later, when the video was released of a concert in the same tour, that he did it by a simple lighting technique. He was there all along in the shadows, and then suddenly lights full glare on him at that moment that he began singing, and he was there. And magic of the theatre. So I wanted something of that. So I wanted to write music was the first thing. And found that when I sang songs in pubs with bands, people weren't that interested, but had an opportunity to, or created an opportunity to write some songs for a little musical that I decided I'd put on for one teacher who I got on particularly well with, who was leaving in the end of my lower sixth. Got a much cleverer friend than me who wrote the play bit to it, and got a performance of my songs and discovered people actually sit in a theatre and listen attentively. And also you get to play your songs loads of times because other people have to learn them. So it was a brilliant way to do songs. And eventually I ran out of people to write my play bits for me. So I had to do it myself. So I'm a failed musical writer and a failed Ziggy Stardust.
Well, not quite failed. I mean, we might want to come back to that a bit later on. So. the road not travelled, I believe, has been travelled now. But
yeah, well, so, that's really good fun. Shall I just say it now?
Yes, please do, because it connects, doesn't it?
I last year during the pandemic, I did one of these Zoom things with a group of teachers and mentioned the music. And I think at that point I was doing YouTube videos about my songs dating back to the 1970s and coming up to when I stopped writing music, which was in about 1985. This lady, Kirstine Stafford, said, "We'd love you to write a musical for our school." And so we were commissioned very shortly after that to write a documentary musical called Nine Teens, about nine teenagers over the last eight decades. Collaborated with it on it with another musician who's written some of the songs, and I've written some of the songs, and it's just been the best fun. And that's going to be premiered in October of 2023.
Just felt like a little bit like Graham Norton there for a minute.
And I'm also writing another one at the moment. I write a version of what was Happy Soap, then Wacky Soap, and it's gone back to Happy Soap. And Fiona Spargo Mabbs, mother of Daniel, has adapted the Happy Soap story to use it as a drug education piece for junior schools and lower secondary as a way of getting into talking about drugs without having all the kind of baggage that comes with it. And we're working on a new Happy Soap musical, which we hope is going to be out in 2024. So, yeah, doing lots of music, which is absolutely lovely, really lovely.
But nice to kind of go back to where you started from, I suppose.
Yeah, really good.
So how did the verbatim stuff come along then? Because if you were, I mean, if you were creating music, surely verbatim doesn't seem to be the natural fit with that. Where did that?
But along the way, as well as David Bowie, I met other people who were quite significant, and one of those other people was in my first teaching job at the what was then the amazing Stantonbury campus. And the director of drama, they had a head of curriculum drama, a deputy head of curriculum drama, two little baby teachers, me and Richard, who were two young guys. I was 21. And Roy Nevitt, who was the director of drama, which was a very grand title. And he did a very grand job. And what he did in the evening is run a community theatre in Milton Keynes. And his idea, because Milton Keynes was very new, this was the late 70s, early 80s. So it was a community made up of disparate other communities coming in and all moving into this area, having no common history. So he wanted to do stories from that community to tell them. He used to refer to it as digging where you stand. And so he did stories of people who had lived in the community who had done something special. The one that I saw first was called Your Loving Brother Albert, who was a 16 or 17 year old who went into the First World War and was killed very quickly, but had sent a number of letters to his sister. Mm-hmm. And these letters were discovered in an attic, and Roy, using only the letters, created a drama. And I went to see it and was absolutely mesmerised by it, but was a bit kind of, oh, I don't think I can do this in front of him. But when I went to my second job in Epping, I knew one of the things I wanted to take there was this idea of using stories. I didn't want to use historical stories. I wanted to use modern day stories. And at that point, that's where I met Graham Salmon, and Race to Be Seen started me off. And that was the first play I had published as well. The story of Graham Salmon, the amazing blind athlete.
Why did you not want to do historical stories? What drew you to something like Graham's story?
I guess I'm always a bit put off by history, and I wanted to chat to people rather than do lots of reading and sifting over documents. I thought it would be much nicer to chat to people, and contemporary people are also interesting. And Graham was absolutely amazingly interesting. Well, before we did his story, we did consider doing Louis Braille. And I thought, that's going to be really hard to figure out. Where do we get the information from? It was just too hard. So I thought, well, there must be someone local who would be of interest. And sure enough, there was. And boy, was he interesting. And he was about to participate in the European Championships, and I said to him, well, whatever happens in that, we will use that as the last scene. And bless him, he went and won the gold medal at that European Championship, so we got our ending as well.
Just for you.
Just for us. And he said he was really, because it had no coverage back in those days, literally no coverage. So he said that one of the things in his mind was us sitting there waiting for the result, and it really mattered to us and it really mattered to him. So it was a motivation to him to do well as well. And he broke the world record as well in that race.
Yeah, you'd think somebody like that would be really well known now. I mean, if you think about how famous our Paralympians are.
Yeah, he's reckoned to be the first Paralympian who did sufficiently well for England to put us on the track of being a world Paralympian success. So in their history, he's super important. But I wanted to bring him to bigger attention.
Mm. In that little description, you referred to wanting to talk to people. I mean, that kind of gives me is that an insight into your process when you're creating a piece?
Yeah, definitely, because I also don't want to just tell people what to do in terms of the direction of a play. So I don't think I've got the ability to do that. And I don't want to put a ceiling on the young people that I'm working with. They come full of ideas. So my process would be to get them to show me what they can do, and I'll try and improve on that. So the whole thing is very collaborative, and I found it's been my kind of creating lots of friends. I've got lots of friends who I've written plays about. I've got lots of friends who I work with in youth theatre, it's become a really lovely way of meeting people and having fantastic relationships.
Would you always work with young people?
I did always, because I was a teacher and I didn't have time to work with older people. I worked, Too Much Punch for Judy came along, and I was invited to be the director of the first touring production of that. They were still young because they were just out of drama school. So they were 21 or two. They're probably the oldest that I've ever worked with. I've worked in workshops with adult amateur actors. My job kind of made me work with young people, and I don't regret that at all. And I've worked with so many fantastically able, willing and committed people. I mean, that's the other thing about young people. They didn't have other things like children and stuff coming into their life, so they were able to offer enormous commitment. Sometimes we were working 9 hours a week in the evening to do productions, you know, so it was an enormous commitment I was asking of them, and in return they got trips to Hong Kong and where was the other place, Houston. So we got some good stuff back, and drama festivals around England.
You've talked about drama festivals before. How yeah. important are they to your the way that your work developed and where it was kind of honed?
Well, when we were doing Race to Be Seen, we said we've done all this work, and that was one of the 9 hour a week things. We've done all this work. We can't just do three performances in the evening and then that's it. So it was too much effort for too little, I'm going to say reward, but too little opportunity to show off what we'd done. So we did a tour. We went to Graham's old school. We went to other schools, I think. And then Graham's PE teacher worked in Edinburgh, and he said, oh, we've got this festival in Edinburgh that happens every summer that I'd vaguely heard of, but I associated it with the comedy thing with Monty Python.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, okay, and can anybody do it? Yes, you can. And what's more, we'll give you accommodation while you're up here. And if you do some workshops in the sports hall with our young visually impaired people, we'll give you free accommodation. So that's how we paid for our accommodation, by doing workshops in the morning with them. And that introduced us to the Edinburgh Festival, which was a week of really enjoyable stuff, performing to people who weren't our parents. And from that, we found there are local festivals. There's the All English Theatre Festival, and they have rounds, which we for 20 years never got beyond the first round. And then suddenly in 2010, when we were doing Stop the Traffic, we got through to the final. Race to Be Seen. We got through to the English final, and then Stop the Traffic after that. We got through to the British final. And then got through to the final twice more after that. But it took us 20 years of never going beyond the first round, but thoroughly enjoying showing it off to people and seeing other people's work. One more thing is that we were introduced to the work of Hull Truck in 1984 at the Edinburgh Festival. I can remember John Gobber was premiering Up and Under, and I can remember watching that with our group and thinking, well, they've done so much better than we did with our 400 metre race with their final rugby match. So the next time I did Race to Be Seen, we did a much, much, much better final race and got the audience kind of really going and clapping and cheering and so on.
Having not got anywhere near the finals for quite a long time, what did you get out of the festivals? I mean, other than another audience?
Yeah, another audience was definitely one of the things. We got the impact of seeing other people's work. We got a professional adjudication, which was really useful if you take note of it, which we didn't for years. One of the things they used to say to us is people aren't in your group, aren't pronouncing their consonants. Is that they call consonants? and we ignored that for years and years and years. And then when we did Missing Dan Nolan and we came second to bottom, this was brought up, and the adjudicator said to us, no matter how good the play is, if we can't hear the words, we can't tell how good the play is. We really worked on consonants at the end of that. We entered another drama festival, I think it was the EFA, and we won. And so from that point onwards, it was kind of T's and D's were really, really, really important. So there was that. There was the thrill of being involved in a drama festival where we were all celebrating doing dramas, getting us out of our little theatre. It was quite a challenge to do that. And the adjudications for me personally, and for some of the actors, they used to win awards, so they might be get best youth actor, even though the whole group didn't go forward. We won individual awards, so some of the individuals won best youth actor. I sometimes got best direction, which was really exciting. And so there were those awards that kind of kept us going. And they were motivating, and that was good for the school, and we could then, kids would get stuff in assembly, and it was a bit like sports awards, you know, they had some kind of value. Sorry, there was one thing I didn't say about what I got from it. If you, on the back of my books, you'll see that I'm able to put little quotes from the adjudication, and they served me really well, because it's all very well me saying, oh, my plays are wonderful, but what I need is other people to say that. And I had these adjudications written down. I didn't do that in order to get that, but in retrospect, that's been very useful.
If you were asked by a drama teacher, a theatre educator, about developing work with young people, what are your top tips?
Get it performed, because it's no good sitting on a page. It needs to be performed. That's the toppest tip. The other thing is to listen if people offer you advice, and then make a considered decision about whether or not you want to take that advice. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. There have been times where we've left an adjudication and said, they just don't get what we're doing. And we stood by what we were doing and went forward into the next round and did the same thing, and it was right. If you keep getting the same comment, I like to see, if I'm given tickets for a production, complimentaries for my production, people put me at the front, I'd much prefer to sit at the back, because I can look at how the audience are reacting. That's a really good gauge as to what's going on, and you can see when people fall asleep, when people bolt upright, and when they laugh, when they cry, and your rewrites are going to be based upon those observations. Again, considering, the difficult thing is it the performance of the kids that's doing it, that's making it good, bad, or is it the writing? That was something that was always very, very difficult to discern. But seeing it in rehearsal, I would generally blame the writing and go back and rewrite. And if we had one of the young people who I work with sitting here, they'd say, oh, Mark always gave us thousands of rewrites. So, yeah.
So it's being open and flexible to kind of new concepts and new ideas then, as well as...
In real life, I don't think I'm particularly open and flexible, but in my professional life, I'm very, very much more so, which is odd. I can't explain that. But
you tackle some very difficult subjects with the work that you do. And, the implication of what you're saying is that people ask you to do it.
Not always. I don't think any of them are very difficult. So I don't have this view that they're very difficult. I think they're really interesting. So, for example, when we took on Graham, I don't think there's anything more fascinating than seeing how someone who hasn't got any eyes, and he had no eyes, so he doesn't see black, he doesn't see grey, he doesn't see little shades of light. he sees what my knee sees, which is nothing. That whole, how does he dream? That was one of the things we asked him. That's a fascinating thing. How does he run? How does he manage to get these world records? There are so many questions. And suddenly doing a play about him enabled us, and it was a group of us who interviewed him, to ask all these different questions. And the answers sometimes were tragic, sometimes they were really funny. That Race to Be Seen is one of the few plays where there's some really big laughs, and sometimes really poignant. So there's a scene in that play where he witnesses, and he was the only witness to a hit and run accident. And people are coming up to him saying, "What did you see?" They didn't even realize he was blind. And he has to deal with that. And so those kind of things that emerge. So none of the plays that I've done did I ever think were particularly difficult issues. Other people have said to me, "Oh, they're really difficult issues." They were just issues that, for one reason or another, we came across. So again, for example, Hard to Swallow came about because one of the girls in my Too Much Punch for Judy group had anorexia. So my natural thing was, and no one was helping her. The doctor had said to her, "Go home and eat a bit more." And it's like, well, if a doctor's saying that, there's something wrong. This was back in 1986, so this is a long while ago. But I wanted to bring into the forefront some understanding of anorexia, because I'd seen someone who wasn't getting the right help. So these things kind of emerge from situations that I've been thrown into. Too Much Punch for Judy grew out of an improvisation in class from a young girl whose dad was a recovering alcoholic, and she came up and talked to me afterwards, and that in a roundabout way led to Too Much Punch for Judy.
Perhaps I phrased it wrong. Perhaps it's that maybe what's interesting about your work is the fact that you've got people who are in what might be regarded as difficult situations to talk to you openly about them, and that has formed the basis of the work. And therefore it has a kind of authenticity, maybe. Somebody writing about that topic from scratch doesn't have.
And I don't
have that kind of authenticity important to you?
Very. And I don't have this thing of we've changed some of the scenes for dramatic effectiveness or whatever. I very much don't change. I use the real words of real people. That was an important rule. It's a backbone to all my work. It needs to be. Why should I superimpose my thoughts as a guy who's a drama teacher onto someone who's experienced living as a blind person, an anorexic, someone whose young child has gone missing or has died of drug misuse? I can't possibly guess what they would think when they're telling me what happened. So it's their story, it's not mine. And I always give them editorial control over what I'm doing, not over how other people remember their stories, because there may be some difference in those accounts, but over their own memories, I shouldn't have editorial control over that.
You say you don't regard these subjects as difficult, so is there anything that you wouldn't touch? Is there any subjects that you perhaps would go, no, I don't feel able to engage with that?
I think there are things that would never get performed, and so that would mean I wouldn't bother with it. Nothing I've been asked to do, I've said no to, if that answers the question.
Okay, yeah, it does. Because you've been asked to do some quite challenging things.
But I suppose these,
yes, perhaps. That people are able to take you into their stories.
Yeah, and knowing that I'm going to throw it out there and make it public domain stuff. That's the difficulty for the people.
But in some cases, they want that, don't they? I mean,
a number of
Missing Dan Nolan.
Yeah. Dan's mum very much wanted
you know, the I love you, mum, I promise I won't die.
And Dan, Dan's mum as well.
And Game Over are all plays which are, they are warnings, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, they are stories. In Game Over, I wasn't offered the opportunity to speak to Lewis Daines, who was Breck's murderer. That would have been a very, very interesting dilemma had I have been offered the opportunity to speak to him, or had I, or should I have actually approached him. That maybe I don't want to give his view of what happened airtime. So that might be a situation where I might make an editorial decision not to, but I wasn't put in that situation because I didn't seek his views, and I didn't I wasn't asked. And I would also, I think I would have asked Breck's mum if she were happy with me talking to him, and if she were, I would be. And I don't know what the answer to that would have been. I should suspect it would be no, I wouldn't want you to talk to him. And I'd abide by that in that situation, because you're dealing with someone who has committed a heinous crime. And that's maybe where I draw the line.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting that you know, because you are so open about it, that you have a line in some ways. But I also understand why that line. I get that.
Yeah,
completely.
But I'd allow Breck's mum to draw that for me.
Yes.
So I would be quite happy to involve his view, and then they'd have an opportunity to answer it. So I can remember in the Dan Nolan story, the two families who had boys who were with Dan on the night he went missing, two of the three boys who were with Dan, were a little bit anxious about their boys being put under the microscope. In the play, and what I said to them is, if they and you tell your story, you will have an opportunity to say what your views are. Otherwise, it's just going to be the account from Dan's mum and dad and sister. And when they thought about it, they eventually decided that they would be involved. But it wasn't a contentious thing to involve them. For them, it was a big decision of whether they wanted to put their children through the process of doing the interviews.
What keeps you going? What makes you keep going with this?
I think, well, when
it's a lot of work, and you've got a body of work behind you now.
Yeah, I spent all morning writing one email to a teacher from New Zealand who had written to me asking for details of my plays. And I hadn't got a template to write back to her. So what kept me going on that was, it was lovely to talk to someone from so far away who was really interested in what I'd done, sufficiently so to make the effort to communicate with me. And literally, I've probably spent 2 or 3 hours writing a very long email offering her ideas about my plays. So I don't know whether that's ego or whether it's just feeling proud of what I've done or wanting to get more sales, or just being an enthusiast, or being obsessed. It could be any of those. It gives me a sense of purpose. And I think when I left teaching, which I loved, if I'd have had nothing to do, I think my whole sense of purpose would have gone. So it continues to give me a sense of purpose, and I'm really grateful for that. And I'm not sure how well I'll cope with the day that might arrive any minute now, when I haven't got a new play to write, because I certainly see no point in just writing a play and no one's going to perform it. So that's not something I want to do. But if someone commissions me to write a play, there's a goal in mind. And I love going to the premieres. I love not being the person who has to deal with the hassle of putting it on. That's really nice. Although I quite enjoyed that as well. It was a very happy place to be in a rehearsal room. But I can do without the stress of someone saying I can't turn up to rehearsal today because I've got a barbecue tonight, and then I'm going to have an argument about that.
We're doing these three nights of performance, miss. I'm not going to be there on Saturday because I'm going to be at a rugby dinner. This one that I've had. Have you ever had to teach one of your plays?
I didn't teach my plays at all. They were always productions I did in the evening. And then a colleague I was working with, the lovely Johnny Carrington, who went on to write Bang Out of Order. Johnny came into my department and he said, "You're missing a trick here because loads of other teachers are using your plays. And so you should." And he did it for a year. And then brought me in to talk to them. And then I thought, oh, this is really stupid. And it was me feeling that I was being egotistical doing it, that it would be a bad idea. But after that, we did. And that was about 2000. And he arrived in 2001. So it would have been 2002 that I started to teach my plays. Yeah, that was a strange experience. But I've seen other people teach my plays, which is lovely. I saw Andy Kemp teach Butcher, Butcher, Burning Bright, which was great. And I loved seeing that. That was a really interesting thing to see him using ideas in a way I would never have thought of. And I love doing workshops. So I've recently done lots of workshops in schools on Hard to Swallow. And the development I've seen with things like the Billy Goat scenes, I would never have worked up unless I'd done that workshop so many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's been really interesting to teach my plays, which I now do because I go off and do workshops.
But not planning on giving up anytime soon?
I'm not planning on giving up, but I'm aware that, things change and it could all suddenly stop tomorrow and I'd be devastated if it did.
So, my feeling is, Mark, that you're going to be asked to keep writing until such time as you're the one who's going to have to say no more, because people are so much interested in what you've got to say and the way that you do it. So I'm going to call things to a halt there. And
thank you very much
for your time and your company. Always a pleasure.
And thank you very much, and yours.
If you've enjoyed this month's episode as much as we hope you would, and you're in a position to do so, please support our podcast via Buy Me a Coffee. Go to www.buymeacoffee.com/halfhourcall to donate.